You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Tuesday, July 5th, 2011, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Rebecca Watson.
Hello, everyone.
Jay Novella.
Ew.
And Evan Bernstein.
Good evening, eh?
Nope. Oh, boy. Did you run out of languages already?
Don't accuse me of that, Bob. We had to get to Canadian at some point.
You hoser.
Oh, boy.
French Canadians are furious right now.
Both really, of them. Like, did you fall out of bed 10 minutes ago? What's up?
Well, all right. Redeem yourself, Evan. Tell us what's special about today.
All right. So July 9th, and the year was 1595.
One of my favorite years. Top five.
Top five, boys. Yeah. Johannes Kepler, who we've spoken about many times on this show, well, it says he published his Mysterium Cosmographicum, which is translated as Mystery of the Cosmos. Now, I looked this up a little bit further, and I have more references referencing that this was the actual date he made the discovery, or he had the epiphany, as it were, as he was teaching his class, rather than actually the work getting published. The work got published a year later. So I'm going with the fact that he came up with the epiphany, the idea. And the idea is, well, I mean, Kepler said it best in his official title of this book, which is Forerunner of the Cosmological Essays, which contain the secret of the universe on the marvelous proportion of the celestial spheres and on the true and particular causes of the number, magnitude, and periodic motions of the heavens established by means of the five regular geometric solids.
Right.
Sorry, I missed that. Can you say that again?
Available on Kindle and other ebooks, I'm sure.
What's cool is that at this point in his career, Kepler was essentially the equivalent of a crank. He had an idea that was little more than, you know, mental masturbation, pattern recognition, and then elaborated on it significantly. It was this beautiful, elegant, geometrical, mathematical pattern, pareidolia, but it had absolutely nothing to do with reality. Of course, if he never got past that, if he never got past his beautiful, you know, idea, we wouldn't know his name today, or he would be a footnote somewhere, but he basically would have been a crank. But that's not what happened.
Well, when did Kepler's laws come out? Was it soon after this, or I forget?
It was after he collaborated with Tycho Brahe.
Yeah, that was a fruitful collaboration.
My favorite scientist.
Yeah. And not long after Brahe died. And this was about 25 years later, Kepler's book, Epitome, The Epitome of Copernican Astronomy, in 1615, so 20 years later. And that's where his three laws of planetary motion were contained, in which he came to the mathematical proofs about how planets revolve around the sun in ellipses, not in perfect circles or any other perfect sort of geometry having to do with it. It was still a mystery, though, as to why why planets orbit in ellipses. And as Carl Sagan reminds us in his brilliant series Cosmos, that these are not only the laws that our planet and the planets in our solar system obey, but it's universal. Everywhere in the universe this occurs.
Well, he didn't know about gravity.
That's kind of a key thing to be missing.
He had to wait for Newton.
How could he not know about gravity, though?
Well, you take it for granted, but he didn't.
Wasn't quantified, you know, mathematical gravitation.
No, but even conceptually, right? I mean, they didn't even know that there was that all matter attracted all other matter to itself in some force. You know,
right. It was even worse. Yeah, mathematics.
They were thinking about it in ways that are bizarre to our modern concept of things. I don't know what the actual state of thinking was in Kepler's time, but if you go back to like Aristotle, they were thinking that the universe, things have a natural tendency to move towards the center of the universe. You know, which of course was the center of the Earth. They were thinking in those kind of terms, not Not anything equivalent to what we think of as gravity.
Well, over the weekend, while we were celebrating Bob's birthday and the 4th of July, happy birthday, Bob.
Happy birthday, Bob.
Happy birthday.
Happy birthday.
Thank you.
I was talking about gravity, and I said something like, you know, if there's anything magical out there, it's gravity. Like, think about it. We were just started tripping out about how weird gravity is. I mean, we really don't understand it. As we all know, gravity is what? It's like a bowling ball on a big trampoline. It leaves like a dimple in space-time or whatever. What the hell does that mean?
Well, that's not even apparently a good way to look at it, right? I mean, I've heard that that's – so it's become far too pervasive, and it's apparently so oversimplified that it's giving people a lot of false – like a false image of what gravity actually is. But hell if I have a better image to give people.
Well, it's one of those things. It's hard to say we know what it is or we don't know what it is. We know a lot about gravity. We have models of what it is in terms of, you know, mathematically, in terms of space-time, et cetera. I mean, that's the whole general relativity thing. So it's not – but it is, you know, just why is it the way it is that we don't know? That there's a deeper level question there that we have not penetrated yet. Probably – at the heart of that is quantum gravity, right? Which is a problem that we have yet to solve. But at least we know where to look, sort of. You know, if we're going to say, like, what aspect of physics is, you know, strikes us as magic? I mean, I definitely think that quantum mechanics has to get the prize there, right?
Oh, absolutely. But Jay's point's well taken, though. This spooky action at a distance type thing with. That applies to various things like gravity, magnetism, and then there's also quantum mechanics, of course, entanglement and all that stuff. But yeah.
Right. Well, I mean, I think aren't all forces spooky action at a distance, just that the gravity, the distance is really big, right?
That's right.
Nuclear forces are just really short. they're very short. But they're still acting at a distance.
Yeah.
It's also a little too convenient, isn't it? it holds us to the earth. I mean, really?
Anthropic principle.
Oh, yeah. It goes without saying.
That's right. If the universe weren't exactly the way it is now,
it would be different.
It would be different. Exactly.
We all have three eyeballs.
Speaking of which, Bob, tell us about astronomers' attempts to reclassify galaxies.
This is pretty interesting. I enjoyed doing research on this one. I love it when 80-plus years of conventional wisdom gets defenestrated. Don't you, Steve?
All the time, yeah.
I'm sorry. People just don't use that word enough, so there it is. So you'd think after 80 years, we'd have a decent idea about galaxy classification. It was over 80 years ago that Hubble really figured out what was going on with galaxies, that galaxies even exist. But now scientists from the University of Oxford in New Jersey – wait a second. Oh, wait. This is the Oxford University that's in the UK. They've concluded that 66% of all elliptical galaxies are not ellipticals at all, but they're called naked spirals. So this is a major deal in terms of galaxy classification, and the proverbial textbooks will definitely need to be revised on this one. I think I just need to quickly go over just some of the major galaxy classifications. You guys are familiar with there's elliptical galaxies and spiral galaxies. They're pretty much the main classifications. You've got the irregular ones, but they're kind of special case, and there's really no real structure to those guys. So the ellipticals and the spirals, I think, are the most important. The ellipticals they're basically back to the ellipse. They've got this ellipsoidal shape to them. They're very smooth and featureless, and they're generally spherical or flat. And most elliptical galaxies, they're older. They've got these low mass stars. There's not much star formation going on there. But the other major type is the spiral, which everyone is familiar with. Everyone has seen thousands of pictures of these beautiful spiral galaxies that they're disc-shaped. They've got these dusty curving arms going around, and they're very flat. The rotating disc with the central bulge, very, very beautiful. Now, there's also another subclassification of spirals, and these are the barred spirals. These are the ones that they've got this barred structure going through the core. They're actually very, very striking. I really like barred spirals. And actually, there's some good evidence to suggest that the Milky Way is actually a barred spiral.
Yep.
So that's kind of a quick overview of what these major galaxy types. It turns out, though, that if you want to actually identify these galaxies, and we've seen millions of them, it's actually kind of hard to classify them because, you know, you can imagine these galaxies existing in three-dimensional space. They can present themselves in any orientation to us, any angle. So the differing angles can really make it difficult to get a handle on exactly what the structure is to in order to classify it. So then if you could imagine these older spirals, these really old spiral galaxies, if you see them face on, you really don't have a great idea that they're, that you don't know that you're seeing them face on. And actually some of these older guys, there's like very little dust in them. It's really hard to see the spirals. I think the spirals actually can kind of unwind and kind of diffuse themselves after a really long time. But they, at any rate, they're very hard to detect if they're even there. So they actually look like it's an elliptical galaxy, and you're not sure if this is this an elliptical galaxy or is this an act, or is this a spiral galaxy. So it's really difficult. So the key way to distinguish these two then is actually the rotation rate, right? Because these ellipticals, there's kind of like no real net rotation. There's no uniform direction to them like you would have in these fast rotating spirals. So enter this new Atlas 3D survey, and this is exactly what this survey was designed to do, is to actually figure out what was going on with some of these non-spiral galaxies. And the survey looked at about 260 of these non-spirals, as they call them, and what it did was it overlaid this grid pattern over the galaxy, and then it looked at the spectra, the light signature of every section of that grid pattern, and it looked at, you know, where's the red shift? Where's the blue shift? Because if it's red shifted, you know it's moving away. If it's blue shifted, you know it's kind of going towards you. And my take on this is that this is very subtle, because if you imagine, if you've got a spiral that's face on, it's face on like a plate looking right at you, the motion is really either counterclockwise or clockwise, right? There's really not going to be a lot of motion that's going away or directly towards you. So even if the galaxy is at a bit of an angle, there's not going to be that much motion. So because I talked to a few people about this, and they were like, well, what took them so long to figure this out? And I just think that, I'm just guessing that some of these blue and red shifts were pretty subtle, and this Atlas 3D survey was fairly powerful. So when they looked at the results, they're like, wow, two-thirds of what we once thought were ellipticals are clearly spirals that have, they just don't have this dust and gas, and they call them these naked spirals. The other key aspect of this whole thing is that the tuning fork diagram. Steve, Jay, have you guys heard of the Edwin Hubble's tuning fork diagram? You've probably seen.
Sure.
Imagine the classic shape of a tuning fork, where you've got the handle and you've got these two prongs coming out. Now, in the handle, you've got the ellipticals, and then on one prong, you've got the regular spirals, and then on the other prong, you've got the barred spirals. And Edwin Hubble came up with this diagram 80 years ago, and his thinking was that the ellipticals evolved into the spirals. But since the ellipticals really don't have any real net rotation, it's really no way to really, you know, think of them actually becoming elliptical. So his idea was wrong, but the diagram itself actually is valid, and you could actually classify the type of spiral it is or type of elliptical it is based on where it is on this tuning fork. So, but you've got a problem now, right? How do you reconcile this new information with this diagram that astronomers have used for eight decades? So what they're doing then now is they're calling this the Atlas 3D comb. So they're adding another prong. They're adding another prong to the diagram. So then what you would have was you'd have the handle, which is the ellipticals, the true ellipticals, and then you'd have three prongs, the spirals, barred spirals, and then you'd have the naked spirals as another kind of prong. So they're calling this the Atlas 3D comb.
So we went from a tuning fork to some kind of salad fork.
Well, yeah, I mean, that was my problem, Evan. It's funny that you should say that, because, you know, three prongs or three tines, to me, that's not a comb. You're right. That's a fork. It's like a salad fork or whatever. But they already had fork in the tuning fork, so they figured, we'll just go with the comb idea, I guess. All right. I could deal with it.
Yeah, well.
Have you guys played with the Galaxy Zoo?
No.
Yeah. What is
it? No, I haven't had a chance yet.
I washed my hands when I was done.
It's interesting. What I didn't expect was that the pictures of the galaxies are not as good or high res as I was imagining they were going to be. I'm like, oh yeah, I would love classified galaxies. I was expecting to see pictures of beautiful spirals and whatever, but it's a lot of really grainy clumps. Galaxy Zoo is a way to play at classifying galaxies. So they give you images of galaxies from Hubble, and then they walk you through the features to look for to describe and classify the galaxy. So, like,
they're taking advantage of human pattern recognition.
Yes. And people can actually get pretty good. You can get good at classifying galaxies.
It's similar to the Foldit thing we mentioned last week or the week before.
Or folding at home, just, yeah.
Yeah, you're taking science and giving it to the masses for them to learn more about your research and also for the research to get done, which is pretty cool.
Yeah. Rebecca, there were a couple of instances of pareidolia this week that are worth mentioning.
Well, yeah. Regular listeners will know what we mean when we say pareidolia. That's the idea of when you look at an image, it's very easy for the human brain to recognize faces, things it finds very familiar. And then your brain can also sometimes have a tendency to make it into a face that you maybe think you recognize, not just any face. And often the face that you think you recognize takes on a religious tone. So in this case, the Virgin Mary appeared in a bird dropping. That's basically what I was getting to, yep. A bird wow. dropping.
It's a sign.
It's a long lead up to talk about bird yeah. poop, but it was worth it, I think.
What's not mentioned in the article was that when this discovery was made, it was the people who discovered it promptly declared it a miracle. But Batman and Robin were walking by right at that time, and Robin turned to Batman and said, "Holy crap, Batman."
Oh, Steve, man. Tell me you made that up.
Wow.
I did.
Oh, good. All right.
68.
If you repeated a joke that was that bad, that would be one thing. But
I think it's pretty bad one way or the other.
I'm glad you took the chance, Steve.
You know, I kind of liked it, Steve.
All right, thanks.
I can relate.
But also, you know, I don't see it. I'm usually pretty good at seeing the pareidolia you're supposed to see in this stuff. I don't see it.
It just looks like maybe the top of her cloak, you know?
Well, yeah, I can kind of see that, but is that it? There's no face.
No, That's it.
Also, we should note that this news item is actually from 2 years ago, from July 2009. But for some reason, it's making the rounds again on the internet, so we thought we would include it this week.
But there are other examples of pareidolia that have happened recently, like Jesus taking the form of some weeds on some power lines, mm-hmm. I believe.
I like that one.
Creeping Jesus.
Yeah, because...
With Jesus, form you know, of weeds.
It's similar to... I remember after September 11th, there was a photo that was making the rounds on the internet that was a sign of Jesus watching over us because there were two steel beams that were left standing in the shape of a cross. Mm-hmm. And to those of us who are slightly skeptical of these things... You know, my initial reaction was, well, how common is a cross? How many crosses of steel beams could there possibly be in a building? And so I think this is along those lines. It's basically some weeds on a power line forming a cross.
Well, yeah, if you imagine power lines going along a telephone pole, so there's a little bit of the pole that sticks up above the power lines. So, yeah, and any telephone pole with the power lines crossing it has that basic shape.
Yeah.
And the specific weeds growing on this one are the kudzu, is that how you pronounce it? Kudzu.
I think so, yeah.
Which is a sort of invasive weed that's out of control in the area, in a lot of the south of the United States, actually. And the person who discovered it, I mean, this is the best quote of the week, I think. "You can't spray Jesus with Roundup."
That's so true.
Yeah, that is true.
He would just grow back anyway 3 days later.
Yeah, that's true.
Exactly.
I like this. The face is very clear. There's a clear brow, you know, eyebrow ridge. There's a nose, mouth from this resolution image that I'm looking at. It's cool that the face is not very ambiguous in terms of just a generic human
really?
Face.
Really? Because I'm looking at the same thing, and it looks like a glub of green.
A
I don't
glub
really
of
see a
green?
Baseball. Glub is a word I made up.
Glub.
Just go with it.
Glub. It's like a glob and a blub.
Perhaps you're looking a little more, you zoomed in a bit. I'm looking at the image from the article, and it's pretty clear that I see a clear face really? Shape, you know, huh. Just very, very, very vague, but the face, you know, the major parts are there. Nose, mouth, eyes.
Wasn't Jesus staked at the hands well, through the palms?
Well, no, that's the old thing that, you know, classically in art, he's depicted as being nailed to the cross through the palms. But a lot of researchers have come to the conclusion that crucifixion was done through the wrist bones because otherwise the hands couldn't support the weight of a person.
That makes sense.
And apparently the wrist is very ideally suited to support weight like that. But then I read somebody else who, this is a few years ago, offered some compelling reasons why that might not be the case. So I'm not sure what the conventional wisdom is nowadays, but
yeah.
Wrists or palms, wouldn't you be hanging in the shape of a Y? Wouldn't your arms be in the Y shape instead of totally out to your side?
Yeah.
And that's part of the point. Maybe this is wrong. I heard this a long time ago, but I've heard that part of the point of crucifixion is that when you're hanging like that, it actually suffocates you because you can't breathe when you're in that position.
Yeah. You eventually get too weak to breathe. That's right. Can't spray Jesus with Roundup.
Awesome quote.
Except when you can.
Evan. Actually, you're right. Sir? This is the one case when you can.
Myth busted.
Tell us about this amazing longevity potion from Easter Island.
Yeah, you'd think by the headline that, you know, Ponce de Leon was right around the corner looking for the Fountain of Youth or something, and it's been discovered. But our friends at the Telegraph have cleverly come up with the title of an article called Elixir of Life Discovered on Easter Island. Well, no, not really. The drug is called rapamycin, which is nicknamed the Forever Young drug, and it's created from a chemical found in the soil on Easter Island.
It's actually produced by bacteria in the soil. Produced by the Streptomyces hygroscopicus bacteria, specifically.
They were able to do this first back in 1964, when scientists brought some of the soil back home. Canadian scientists brought it back home, and lo and behold, it yielded this unexpected treasure, which was a new antibiotic. And it was named after the traditional name of the island, Rapa Nui, which we spoke about several weeks ago. And that's how they came up with the name. So that's very cool. But in any case, this article would have us believe that this drug is a elixir of life or a longevity drug of some sort. And it is, in a way, in one specific way, apparently. It's used in experiments on children suffering from Hutchins-Gilford progeria syndrome.
Ooh, progeria is nasty.
What is that? I've heard it referred to as progeria. Aging. It's mutations of aging. Yeah, you basically age in whole lifetime in 12, 13 years. You suffer from the effects of old age. People have cardiac arrest and strokes and other things.
They look remarkably like just very old, very short people.
This is caused by a process whereby this protein called progerin builds up in our cells in the body, causing them to age prematurely. And this rapid buildup of progerin will rapidly increase this aging process. Now, I guess, all people normally have progerin within their cells, and it just builds up over a longer stretch of time.
That certainly is a big question now. The news item is that a study showed that rapamycin is effective in clearing progerin from the cells from people with the disease progeria. So the question is, would this work in people who, regular people who don't have the disease, and how much of a role does progerin play in the normal aging process? So it seems that it does play a role, and if that's true, then rapamycin might extend lifespan, which is interesting.
Except rapamycin is an immune suppressant.
It's a powerful immunosuppressant drug used to treat organ transplants, specifically kidney transplants. Yeah.
So if a healthy person were to take this, he'd really be putting himself at some serious risk.
Yeah, that's the rub, right? So there is a study in mice, and it did improve the lifespan of mice, even when initiated in mice that were the equivalent of like 60 years old. So, which is good, is you don't have to take it from the time that you're young to get the benefits. Will these benefits transfer to humans? Who knows? It's really hard to extrapolate from mice to humans when it comes to longevity research. But you bring up the other major drawback is that if you're on this drug on a regular basis, the benefits may be outweighed by the fact that now you're immunocompromised. You know, you could be knocked over with a cold. That's a problem. However, if it's an important proof of concept. If it works, even if it has this major downside, it could mean the potential for creating another version of the drug that has the benefits without being a powerful immunosuppressant. But of course, that pushes clinical applications farther down the road if you then have to start from scratch with a new version of the drug. But it still, it's, it actually is a much more interesting scientifically line of research than I had originally thought it was going to be just from reading those headlines. Oh yeah, elixir of life, yeah. But it, you know, all the ducks are in a row there. I mean, there is a compelling case to be made that this could actually clear this buildup of this protein in cells and give them greater longevity. It's a perfectly reasonable claim, actually.
Is it just a matter of finding the exact correct amount of the drug to take over a certain amount of time?
That's one issue. It's,
you know, side effects.
It's a, yeah, you know, you need to measure net clinical effects. We can speculate endlessly about how this is all going to play out in a human being. But we need to measure net clinical effects. You need to give it to a healthy 50-year-old for 10 years and see what happens.
At least for these poor people who suffer from this horrible disease, progeria.
Oh yeah,
it does seem like a reasonable application.
Yeah, absolutely.
Of this drug, you know.
Yeah, because definitely. The alternative is dying at 12.
Right. Or having a heart attack at 9. Or
yeah,
something.
Which is not the same situation as giving it to a healthy person to prolong their life. Right.
Right. So, Bob, sorry about that. We're gonna have to just wait and see how this one plays out a little further down the road.
There's always a gotcha.
Yep.
Jay, tell us about the advent of driverless cars.
Well, it looks like driverless cars are seriously being considered now. I think the technology has finally gotten to a point where we can see, hopefully in the next, I'm estimating 3 to 5 years, that they're going to be on the road. In 2010, Google announced that they've been working on driverless vehicles. I don't know if you guys heard about this. You know, we all know that Google has people driving all over the planet for Google Maps, but they're also testing their cars on roads that are driverless. And these are public roads that they're doing it on. I couldn't find any information on where they're doing it, and I have seen some video of their tests in parking lots, but I didn't know that they were doing it on public roads. But I guess that they are. Their driverless car is equipped with, of course, video cameras. They have radar sensors. They have a laser rangefinder to see other traffic. I guess they can judge distance with things like that. But they're collecting detailed maps that are collected by cars that I think are similar to the ones that drive around for Google Maps. However, these data collection vehicles go way beyond what Google displays on Google Maps today. This is like a much more detailed terrain map. It's actually, and I'm suspecting, I didn't actually read this, but I think that they're taking more of a 3D map that gives the vehicles a real understanding of the environment. And then Google's data center crunches all this stuff down and then makes it into digestible pieces of information that the cars could actually use to help them navigate. So they're taking some serious readings and throwing them into a database. So when this starts, they're going to have their cars, or the cars that are equipped with the Google technology, are going to be able to be pulling from these maps that they're collecting, which is really cool. I would love to see an example of what they're collecting. They're rolling out cars that are equipped with a technology called self-correcting vehicles. Have you guys ever heard of this before?
Yes.
No.
Yeah, me neither, Bob. And of course,
self-correcting. In what way?
Yeah, so instead of it being like fully autonomous, the first phase that they'll roll out are self-correcting, meaning that the car will help the driver stay in lane, brake assist, avoid obstacles in the road,
yeah,
and things like that. So it's going to be more of an assist, or the car could be unmanned for very short periods of time, or maybe...
It's kind of like an enhanced cruise control then.
Yeah, but I wouldn't even gimp it by saying like a cruise control. All cruise control does is try to keep the car at a speed.
No, but Jay, but cruise control is included in the suite of technologies that you were talking about.
Of course it is, but cruise control is a technological joke compared to the stuff that I'm talking
about.
That's
true, but it's the same idea. The car keeps it within a certain speed, and cruise control would be part of this, but also it would, the other thing that I've heard about mainly with the self-correcting is the braking. Is, if you get too close to the car in front of you, you can have it either first warn you, and then it will actually automatically apply the brake to keep the distance, or if you're about to crash into something, it eventually will brake for you and stop before you hit the obstacle. So it's like collision avoidance.
I thought some high-end cars already had that.
It's true. Just like some cars have cruise control.
Yeah, so Bob, that actually is part of the plan, though. They want to roll this out slowly. They don't want to just come out with a totally automated car, because there'd be too much of a culture shock. So what Google's planning is they're gonna move towards the totally autonomous cars. I would probably say over the next 5 to 10 years, we would be hailing taxi cabs that in Vegas. Actually, Nevada is the first state that has agreed to do this, but I'll get into that in a minute. But one question I have for you guys, and one thing that one of the articles brought up, and one thing that I actually had thought about a number of years ago when I first saw a show on autonomous cars is, so let's say that you're in your autonomous car and you're in the back seat and you're being driven to work or wherever you got to go, and you get into a car accident. Whose fault is it? Mm-hmm. Where does the responsibility lay? You know,
asking, who has the most money?
Well,
yeah, well,
I think it would lay in the records of the accident. I'm sure they're recording just like a black box. They would determine, all right, they would look at the black box for each car and say, all right, what went wrong? Which car made the wrong move? And then at least you can assign blame to the car. And then from there, who knows?
Yeah, but think about that. Okay, so I don't disagree with you, because my first instinct was, well, if you bought the car and your car screwed up, it's your fault. That's it. That's right. You're going to sit in the back, then you got to suck it up and be responsible for your vehicle.
But what the manufacturer would do is go, oh, look at that. You were 33 miles late on your oil change. Therefore, you didn't meet the maintenance schedule that we laid out for you, and that voids our responsibility for the performance of the car.
Yeah, but do you think that Google could be sued, or any company that produces an autonomous car, can they be sued for an accident like this? And I would imagine the legalities of this obviously have to be worked out, but I would imagine that if you're going to engage in buying one of these cars or using one of these cars, that there are going to be a certain number of things or certain types of things that you're going to be responsible for. And then, of course, if there's any manufacturer defect or software defect or whatever, the manufacturer would be. But what's interesting is, like I said before, Nevada was the first state to actually pass a bill that grants the Department of Transportation authority to draft rules and regulations to help the testing and the use of these cars. So I think what they're going to be doing is basically testing the water with one state. You know, I keep reading that Las Vegas is going to be the test city, which I think is safe. The weather there is consistent. You know, they don't get an enormous amount of rain. There's not, you know,
no snowstorms.
Yeah, no crazy weather like that. There is a big change in temperature, but nothing like we see here in New England. So that's very cool.
Yeah. Now, I think that there's going to be a long period during which this technology will be used to assist human drivers, not replace them. That makes sense, you know, once you think about it. Just like there's cruise control, there'll be collision avoidance and optimizing driving, you know, keeping you in line and away from other drivers, and maybe even grabbing your attention if something unexpected happens. So all of the cell phone users or other whatever people whose attention lapses, the car will
multitaskers.
Will compensate for that. And actually, you know, the one good thing about that is that it will keep marginal drivers on the road longer. People who have difficulty driving well because of some injury or infirmity, or just because they're
age, right. Yeah,
because of age, yeah. Which is, you know,
yeah,
is
definitely
a big problem.
Put all the septuagenarians behind.
I wish we really had it now. I mean, I'm watching, you know, watching my dad drive, and it's getting, you know, it's getting a little scary. You know, he's over 80, and he's still a good driver, but man, yeah, the time's coming. I see, you know, I could see the time is coming, and boy, that's going to be a tough conversation, because you lose your autonomy that way, your mobility. My God, it must be devastating.
Right.
So
this technology would be awesome. It'd be
would help
safer.
Extend that.
Right.
Yeah. Also, I
miss Daisy.
I think if it plays out like you think, Stephen, that we kind of ease into it, I think it might accelerate a bit. Once, you know, once most cars have this technology, like all cars have anti-lock brakes now, I think we'll reach a point where most cars have this, some sort of technology related to this. And I think when we see like road deaths drop from 50,000 a year in the United States or whatever it is, 40 to 50,000 down, you know, cut in half or something like that, people will be like, whoa.
Yeah.
I would definitely, like, if they were able to retrofit my car right now with it, I would just get a flat screen TV in there and I'd be playing video games. I would just, like, I'd be like, Rebecca, where are you? In upstate Buffalo? Okay, take me to Rebecca's house, like, 6 hours later.
Yeah, yeah, I'd be down for that.
Yeah, it would be the combination of individual autonomy with the convenience of not having to actually drive, like if you're on a train or a bus where you could do what you want.
The thing is, the machines can't possibly do any worse than the humans are already doing. So
well, that's probably true.
Let's give them a
and
go.
And Steve, yeah. Good for you. You know, on all those nights out drinking and really getting wasted, oh, yeah. I mean, you can get home from the
that's
bar
right.
now.
That's yeah. right, yeah. No more sleeping.
Actually,
the
that
gutter.
Is a really good point, though.
That's right.
That would, you know, pretty much cure drunk driving.
Yeah, productivity, I think, is key. I mean, I'm 50 minutes in my car twice a day, and, you know, I'm always listening to something. If it's not music, then I'm always, like, books on tape. I'm listening to Game of Thrones right now. Oh, boy, do I love it.
Told you.
But it's I try to be productive, and it's like, it seems like such dead time. Being able to actually read, you know, really read or do whatever is just so appealing to me. I can't wait.
Johnny Cab.
Johnny Cab, yeah. So, Rebecca, you didn't tell us about your trip to Dublin. Did anything interesting happen?
Yeah.
No, not really.
No?
Nothing well,
worth,
you know.
Worth talking about?
Blog-worthy or anything?
Yeah, there were a few interesting things that happened. I made a video about them, things like about how I went to this awesome museum that had robot skulls and yeah, it was pretty cool.
Sweet.
Bob just got a Woody robot skulls.
That's gross, but yeah. but it's funny you should mention that because.
Wait! I want to talk about the robot skulls. What can you possibly have that's more interesting than that?
I know. That's what I thought. That's literally what I thought when I made the video I made about my trip. I was sure the robot skulls would be the most interesting thing, but no, I related something that happened at the conference, which was that at the conference itself, I spoke about how basically about how I'm tired of being hit on a lot at conferences.
Sorry, Rebecca, I won't do that again.
It is mostly Evan that does it, but
I'm
you know.
So sorry.
It's all right. It's okay. So yeah, and it was in a broader context of being about how I get tons of mail and a lot of it is sexual in nature and it includes very graphic emails about what men would like to do to me sexually as well as, you know, men who disagree with me threatening to rape me or hoping that I get raped in some way. And these are men who identify as skeptics and atheists. So, when combined with that, you know, being hit on nonstop gets tiring. So I talked about that a bit and I hoped that by talking about it, I would encourage people to pay a bit more attention to what they say, especially to women, because we might be able to make our community a bit more welcoming to women if we just pay attention to how you're making women feel. Well, that night I was at the hotel bar and talking with a lot of just really awesome people, so many fantastic people that I met there, until 4 a.m, at which point I said, you know, I'm exhausted and we've got another day of the conference left, so I'm going to sleep. So I got up and I left, and a man who had been amongst that group but who hadn't previously said anything to me followed me onto the elevator on my way back up to the room. And he said to me, don't take this the wrong way, but I find you very interesting. Would you like to come back to my hotel room for a cup of coffee? It's pretty obvious to most people, I think, that this was a proposition. And I mentioned in my video that this had happened, and I said, you know, don't do that. That is only going to make women feel more uncomfortable. Many women who are already probably a bit uncomfortable at these conferences, you know, hitting on them, especially in that way, when they're alone, you know, in an enclosed space at 4 a.m. in a hotel elevator, don't proposition them.
Yeah. There's a built-in creep factor, right?
Yeah. And that's pretty much what I left it at. Like, guys, please don't do that. Well, uproar. The internet exploded over this, mostly, with people who claimed that I was trying to outlaw sex or, you know, stop all flirting from happening at conferences, calling all men rapists, calling this man a rapist, just completely ridiculous accusations that I found pretty absurd. And it all sort of reached a peak this past weekend when PZ Myers wrote a post about it, sticking up for me. And Richard Dawkins posted in the comments to basically tell me that I had nothing to complain about, that nothing bad happened to me, and comparing what I was saying to the experiences of Muslim women who have been excised and beaten by their husbands and whatnot. So that was all pretty insulting. And here we are now, and it's all over the interwebs. And I wasn't really going to talk about it here on SU, but, you know, it's an important issue, and I'm really glad that you guys recognize it as an important issue, you guys here on the show, and a lot of people, you know.
We actually are bystanders watching this happen a lot, because a lot of the emails you're talking about are coming to the SGU.
Yeah.
So we get to see firsthand. I mean, we get some emails where, again, I always give people the benefit of the doubt. I'm not quick. I don't have a hair trigger in accusing other people of sexism or anything like that. But we get some emails that cannot be explained in any other way except as raw sexism. I mean, against Rebecca, and sometimes really vile. It's just silly.
Yeah, and you know, for a long time I dismissed them because I thought, well, you know, not everybody will like me, and I have to learn to accept that. These seem sexist, but I don't want to cry sexism when, you know, there's probably just a good chance these people just hate my guts and desperately want me to know, things like that. And it really wasn't until you guys brought it up to me that I felt a hell of a lot better about admitting that there was actually a serious problem happening. So,
I think it's a small subset of the community. I have no reason to think it's anything other than that. But, you know, they could generate a lot of noise. The thing I found really interesting is I watched the video that you made, and it seemed like this is like an offhand comment in the middle of the video, and you were clearly just – it was like, oh, FYI, don't be a dick, you know, kind of thing.
Yeah.
And it was very inoffensive. You weren't overreacting in any way. I can't imagine how somebody would watch that and think that you were overreacting. It was so mellow.
Although I do think that there is just in general just a problem of a lot of people, both men and women, who don't necessarily recognize that these things are going on. But I think for most people, when it's called out to them, when it's pointed out, they are open-minded and accepting. That's what happened in Dublin after my talk. The people I spoke to at the bar and everything were just beautiful, because a lot of them said things like, you know, I never really considered that women might go through what you're going through right now, and I appreciate you sharing that. As opposed to this other response that I get, which is, shut up, stop whining, you feminist bitch.
And the point that you were making, which is, again, I don't know that I would have necessarily anticipated this point myself, you know, but once you pointed it out, you know, if you're a woman alone in an elevator, there's something threatening about that situation. And so, you know, guys should just be sensitive to that and not think that, hey, this is a great opportunity to hit on this girl.
Yeah.
Steve, did you read Surly Amy's recent blog post?
No, I didn't get to that one.
On Skeptic, it was really provocative. I mean, basically, she listed off the things that a lot of women may think about that basically shows how vulnerable they feel and how difficult it is. Like, you know, one of them is, you know, like when men tell women to smile. You know, it's innocuous like that. But then it got down into details that, like, very, very profound and scary things that women are confronted with by men. And you know, I read that and I really was reality shift, you know, like I've never had anybody come at me that way. I mean, I actually had someone at TAM say some pretty vile things to me and my fiance, and I got really pissed off, and George got mad. He was standing right next to me and everything. But, you know, for me, I was just like, you know, get away from me. You bother me. You know what I mean? It was like one of those things.
Yeah.
But women are put into positions. Not all women, and of course not all men do this type of stuff, but it does happen. Women are put into positions where they actually are in fear, and bad things result from those situations too. You know, Rebecca, you could have easily been taken advantage of by the wrong person in that circumstance.
Right. I mean, in the case of the elevator guy, you know, nothing happened. I politely declined and took my leave as soon as the doors opened. But had something gone wrong, then what happens in a lot of cases is it turns to the woman, like, well, were you drunk? Well, yeah, I had been drinking. It was 4 a.m. I was at a bar. Well, why did you get into an elevator with some man you didn't even know? And to be fair, you know, these are things that even a lot of women, I think, don't really think about. It had to be pointed out to me that I was behaving in a way that men don't have to behave. For instance, you know, when I'm going out to bars to meet friends, depending on how far I have to walk or whether or not I'm going to be walking alone, I will choose high heels or flats. If there's a chance that I'm going to be walking for an extended period alone, I will always go with flats. Why? So I can run, just in case.
Yeah.
There are tons of things like that that I do every day that, you know, it hadn't even occurred to me before, are purely things I have to do to protect myself from being raped, because we teach women that it's their job to not get raped. And so I think, I hope that by pointing these things out, we do help men understand, because I think that the vast majority of men want to know this stuff because they want to make women feel more comfortable, you know, in general life as well as at skeptics and atheist conferences, you know.
Yeah, I think if anything, there's probably just a huge nerd factor. You know, the guys feel uncomfortable and they're awkward and they don't realize that can make them come off as creepy and predatory and not just nerdy, you know, and maybe that was the situation with this guy. So that's why I thought you were just like, heads up, guys, if you don't know this intuitively, this is the kind of thing that is, you know, will give you a creep factor you probably don't want to have.
But for me, the worst part of this entire thing has been the response. Just sort of, you know, pointed it out in as inoffensive a manner as I can think. Hey guys, don't do this. To have Richard Dawkins, someone who is considered a leader of this community, who we look up to for, you know, for his writings on atheism and on humanism, for him to basically tell me to sit down and shut up, you know, that's hugely damaging, I think. You know, because it also, it tells the women out there who aren't as privileged as me, the women who have been raped, who have been sexually assaulted, who would be in a situation like the one I was in and who would have a panic attack. He's telling them that he's not willing to stick up for them, that he doesn't care how they feel in these situations, and that this man's right to hit on her is more important than her right to feel safe. And I feel that that's antithetical to what we do as skeptics, as humanists. I feel that we should be encouraging people to be welcoming towards all people. And if being welcoming towards women means having a bit more respect and a bit more sensitivity towards how we're approaching women, then I think that that's worth it.
You know, Rebecca, we're going to be in TAM next week in Vegas. And Richard's going to be there, and I think it would be really cool if the two of you actually talked face to face and just cleared the air, because I'd like to think, and
publicly,
I really do.
Jay?
Yeah, why not?
Yeah,
I believe we
should invite him onto the stage with us at TAM, where we're going to be doing 2 hours of live SGU. He's there, Rebecca's there. This is a huge issue, and the thing is that this is an intellectual community. This is how we should. This is an interest. You know, and I give Richard Dawkins the full benefit of the doubt that he meant well, and that he there was a point that he wanted to make. I don't think he intended to offend anybody, but you know, I think he dug himself into a bit of a hole there, in my opinion. I'd be happy to give him the opportunity to make himself more clear in an open forum. I think, and there's some actual interesting issues that were raised. I'm trying to see where he was coming from, you know, so his essential point was, you know, let's put this into the perspective of women in the Muslim world who have to deal with genital mutilation, being stoned to death, and not having even fundamental rights. And there are other communities in the world. Like, we were just talking with Josh Eberger over the weekend about the plight of women in the Orthodox Jewish community who are similarly, you know, orders
treated
of magnitude,
like dirt.
Yeah, more problems than what we're dealing with here. So, right. And I could see, as somebody who is trying to foment outrage about this, again, I'm trying to be generous to his position. He might have been saying, okay, this is all well and good, but let's not forget that there are women in the world who are dealing with much bigger problems.
You are being extremely generous.
Well,
there.
I'm trying to be. But the problem with that is that he essentially is saying that no women have a right to complain anywhere because there's genital mutilation in the Muslim world. It's like
logical fallacy. It's like
there's always somebody worse off than you, but that doesn't mean the thing is women have the right to be absolutely equal to men. And the fact that we're working on going that last yard or whatever, however far you think we are from total equality, we're trying to get there, is in no way delegitimized by the fact that there are other parts of the world, and there's actually even subcultures within our own society where they are still back in the dark ages as far as women's rights are concerned. It's just a non sequitur, and it is a way of undercutting legitimate. Points or legitimate complaints. It's I thought it was a little condescending too.
Oh, it was very condescending. And and he demonstrates that further by comparing my situation to when someone gets on an elevator with him chewing bubble gum. It really annoys him. Yeah. And so he felt that I was simply offended the way he's offended by someone chewing bubble gum. But he just keeps his mouth shut until the person gets off the elevator.
Oh boy.
So yeah, that kind of point missing is just astounding. And I would certainly be happy to speak with Richard at TAM or elsewhere, because I would be interested to know if he's changed his position at all. I know that he's getting a lot of feedback right now on his comments, but last I saw he was holding tight to his opinion. So I'd be interested to see if he moves at all towards a more feminist way of thinking.
Yeah, I mean, I wonder if he was influenced by what other people were saying about your video more, rather than the video itself, because it's like you didn't say anything in the video. It's not like you were claiming that you were harmed or you were claiming that this guy should go to jail. So you just said, this is creepy, don't do it,
Right.
It was so inoffensive. It's just, there's a disconnect there. I'm trying to figure out what the disconnect is.
That's what I thought, Steve. It just seemed to me that, it seemed that some of these people would have had to have just heard about it and heard a distorted version of what happened and then commented. I can't connect what was actually on the video to the reactions. There is, like you said, a disconnect. So that's one way I can reconcile it, but I don't know. Well, I mean, we get emails from people who comment on what we say on the show, and very often we say to ourselves, wait, did you actually listen to it or did you actually hear about it? So it's like – so I know how people – psychologically how people can just misremember. I know how memory is and how you can just kind of – your memory of it changes very quickly over time. I don't know. I don't know what to think about it. It's crazy. It's insane.
You know, there are people that flat out – do have a bone to pick with this issue. You know, there a lot of people are frustrated being one of the men in the skeptical community. I actually am getting kind of tired of hearing about sexism in skepticism, because the skeptical movement is a microcosm of our society. I don't think there's more or less sexist men in our group, and it's not a skeptical problem. It's not a problem with our community. It's people in general. So I think some of those reactions might be frustrated people that are just like, you know, for one reason or another, don't like Rebecca, don't like what they have to say. But I think some of the responders could actually be men that are like, you know, don't lump me in with all these other people, all this other mess.
I think I've been pretty clear from day one that there's nothing especially misogynist about men in the atheist, men and women in the atheist and skeptical communities. And in fact, you know, I've been giving talks a lot recently specifically about sexism in religion, in religious communities, and the way religion makes sexism so much worse. So nowhere have I ever suggested that, and I want to be clear that, you're right. We live in a culture that has a lot of inherent sexism. And I think the problem is that as skeptics and atheists, we think that we are rational people who have applied skepticism to every part of our brain. And we assume that of other people who also self-identify as skeptics and atheists. And that's, that's not true. It's not really even possible. There's always going to be some bias that you haven't examined. There's always going to be something that you haven't applied your skepticism to. And I think we all try as hard as we can to do that. And that's why I think that when I do talk about this stuff, most people are down with it because they like examining parts of their brain that they hadn't really considered before. They like being opened up to new ways of thinking like that. But yeah, there's still plenty of people who react very negatively to being told that there's any kind of sexism in our community. How could there be? We're rational. And so they just sort of close off to it. But luckily not all of them do. And so I do think that we're making progress. I think that we just need to keep, unfortunately, we have to keep talking about it until, you know, we sort of root out the problem. I wish I could stop talking about it, honestly. Like, I mentioned this at a talk a few weeks ago that I love giving funny talks. I like not being serious and joking, but, you know, I feel like I have to talk about it as long as it's making life miserable for a large group of people.
You absolutely should take advantage of the fact that you have an audience, and you know, the bottom line is, I mean, it's a fantastic message, Rebecca, and I don't think that you should feel like, you know, people are getting tired of it. I just don't want to be talking about issues, non-skeptical issues, at events when we're there to talk about science and skepticism and the movement, yeah, and what our goals and educating children. And, you know, I can sit here for 10 minutes and talk about the things I want the community to focus on. I really don't think we should be focusing on sexism, to be honest with you.
Yeah, except, well, it's interesting, though, that for years, I mean, as long as I've been in the skeptical movement, we've been talking about the fact that there is, you know, many more men than women in the movement, and how could we get more women in the movement? Now we have women in the movement who are telling us, well, here's one thing you could do, you know, just be a little bit more sensitive about the latent sexism. And okay, if we really are serious, and we meant it all these years about wanting more women in the movement, then maybe we should listen to that. And maybe they have some insight to provide that as open-minded and as progressive as you want to be. The fact I lived my life as a guy, I don't know what it's like to live as a woman, and you know, I need to listen to the people who have, and if they're telling me quite reasonable things about the challenges that, you know, may not be evident, you know, to me, then I'll listen to that. Just like I remember when I first really got to know Perry well, became very close friends, Perry, who was a really big guy, gave me a peek into the world of FGF, right? What he used to call fat guy friendly. And I had no idea the day-to-day challenges that somebody his size lived with.
A movie seat.
Yeah, right? I mean, that it just
can't
never
go to the movies, yeah, unless you have a seat that can accommodate.
Never occurred to me, but I had to learn it because, you know, being Perry's friend, it's the same thing. You know, you can't really know all of the ins and outs of what it's like unless you've been in that situation, or you have to just listen to somebody who is, you know.
I can totally agree with that, and I think to clarify what I said before, I don't think it's something that we shouldn't talk about or a topic that shouldn't come up. I just would hate to see it, you know, engulf our community and make it to where, you know, we're talking about these issues more than we're talking about.
Yeah. Well, the same issues, there's a dozen issues where the same thing is true. We don't want all of our time and attention to be engulfed by any controversy,
right,
within
autism,
the skeptical.
Yeah.
Or even
vaccines,
just, you know, the skepticism versus atheist, you know, schism.
Right.
You know, we don't want to talk about that every show either. But, you know,
every other show.
But you do got to talk about it sometimes.
Yeah.
You know, how often does it come up on the show? Once a year? You know.
I think we're averaging about once a year.
Yeah,
which is
that,
fine for
that's
me.
It's fine. Which is okay. Well, let's move on, since we've covered this topic thoroughly, to Who's That Noisy?
Yes, it's the time in the show when we play the audio clip that relates to science or skepticism
it is
in some
not.
Way. And, oh, it is. You just haven't had your listening ears on. And we're asking our listeners to identify that noise. In case you missed it, here is last week's Who's That Noisy?
It's George Robb falling asleep at his drunken drum kit at 3 in the morning.
Maybe it was baby George Robb.
That's right.
The cutest thing ever in his tiny little suit.
Playing with the mobile, yeah. That's right. No, but in fact, that was a screw falling into the interior of a turbine engine.
Wow.
Whoa. That's obscure.
That's cool.
From what I told, this is a very distinct sound. And if you're a engine mechanic and you hear that, you're crying, basically, at that point.
That is the sound of failure.
So that's not something you want to hear.
What do they have to do to get it out? They have to take apart the engine?
I suspect it would do some damage, too.
They pick it up and shake it.
Yeah, it's not like you can turn it upside down. And
bring in the shaker. Beep, beep, beep.
Evan, did anybody get it?
Yes.
No.
Absolutely they got it. Yes.
That's
which is amazing. I really didn't think anyone would get it either. Willing to learn from the message boards, his first or her first post. And that's all they had to say. WTN is a screw or other small object falling into the interior of a turbine engine. And one other fellow by the name of Don answered correctly in email, and he just actually sent that in earlier today, but a little too late.
Right.
To learn was
oh,
first.
Man, the person on the forum totally blew it. They could have made their forum name like Engine Repair Guy or something, you know?
Crying Engineer.
Turbines are us.
So very well done.
It's a good one. What do you got for this week?
All right, here we go. This week's Who's That Noisy?
Maybe this is a good time to ask, did anything trigger your interest in the paranormal or UFOs specifically? I mean...
Well, if you have a idea of who that was, please post your message on our forum or send us an email at info@theskepticsguide.org. Good luck to everyone.
All right. Thanks, Evan.
You're welcome.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week, I come up with three science news items or facts, two real and one fictitious. I make up one completely.
Is that what that means?
Yes.
Hmm,
it's made up, not true, false, fake, fiction. It's a lie.
I've learned a lot today.
A mirage.
And then I give my panel of skeptics the opportunity to tell me which one of the three items is actually the fake. Is everybody ready for this week?
Oh, yeah.
Yep.
All right, here we go. Jay, you going to repeat your astounding performance last week?
Highly unlikely, Steve.
Yeah, it's true. Regression to the mean will take over. All right, here we go. Item number one, a new study shows that it is possible to learn how to deliberately forget information. Item number two, research suggests that pigeons are very adept at recognizing human faces. And item number three, medical engineers report that they have successfully built and tested a functioning robotic small intestine that is capable of replacing a significant portion of the small intestine of an animal. Jay, you went last week, so you get to go first this week.
Okay, so the first one is a new study shows that you can learn to deliberately forget information. That doesn't seem that plausible to me. And I would also say that it depends on like what kind of memory it is. Like if it was a horrific accident or you know, some type of bad trauma or whatever, I would imagine that would be much harder than, you know, say forgetting someone's social security number or whatever. But that's interesting though. The second one is research suggests that pigeons are very adept at recognizing human faces. It wouldn't surprise me if pigeons could recognize human faces. I mean, I don't know how intelligent pigeons are in the spectrum of intelligence with birds. I'm a parrot owner, and my parrot is amazingly dialed in as far as the people in the room. He knows who I am. He recognizes my face, my voice, everything. I don't think it'd be that big of a leap to say that pigeons could be good at facial recognition. And the last one, medical engineers report that they have successfully built and tested a functioning robotic small intestine that is capable of replacing a significant portion of the small intestine in an animal. What? There's lots of things about this that I'm not clear about. Like, if they built a fake small intestine, first, what powers it? Second, how does it hook up to the blood supply? Like, how does it actually give the body nutrition? I mean, the small intestine also has tons of small and large intestines has a lot of things that get secreted into it in order for it to do what it's got to do. So I would imagine that those things wouldn't be produced anymore. So where's that stuff coming from? This one seems to be riddled with problems, and that's why I don't think I should pick it, but I think I should. Okay, I'll take that one.
Okay. Evan?
The study that's showing that it's possible to learn how to deliberately forget information. I don't know. How exactly would that work? I'm really having a hard time wrapping my mind around that. No pun intended. I don't think so, but let's move on. Researchers suggest that pigeons are very adept at recognizing human faces. Okay. You know, recognizing faces, I can't imagine, is unique to, you know, Homo sapiens, right? I mean, it's something that we're excellent at, and I would believe that that translates to lots of different animals, and I don't see why not. The last one about engineers have built and tested a functioning robotic small intestine. But you know, I'm not surprised at that, but capable of replacing a significant portion of the intestine of an animal? Well, I imagine it depends on the animal. I imagine that some intestines, not all intestines are the same in all animals. I imagine it's a relatively complex system, but perhaps there are some animals that have a, by comparison, more simplistic small intestine system. I think that one is fascinating and somehow feasible. This one about deliberately forgetting information, I just don't know how you'd go about doing that. So I'll say that one's fiction.
Okay. Now, Bob and Rebecca, and I want to remind you that we are into the second week of our challenge.
Oh.
You both lost last week, so you're even.
Mm-hmm.
That's right.
Okay. So keep that in mind as you guess for this week. And Bob, you're next.
The first one, yeah, I've got a problem with this first one, deliberately forgetting information. It's kind of like, you know, don't think of a pink elephant. How do you, you know, by trying to forget something, you're focusing on it. And so this seems kind of counterintuitive. Perhaps there's some mental heuristic you can go through to help you forget specific information. Maybe it's the nature of the information itself that makes it more easily forgettable than, say, like Jay suggested, some sort of, what do they call it, flash bulb memory, something really dramatic that happens and traumatic that's just like seared into your memory, even though it's not necessarily any more accurate than any
that's
other type
true.
Of memory. So that one's a little bit bothersome. The second one about the pigeons being very adept at recognizing human faces, yeah, that doesn't surprise me. Birds can be the talents of certain birds can be very surprising. You know, the thing that's counterintuitive here is that pattern recognition is such a hallmark of the human brain. How could a little pigeon brain possibly be good at it? That's kind of what the rub here. But I still can buy that based on what I know about birds. And this last one, yeah, robotic intestine. Jay surprisingly hit a lot of good points with this one. How are you going to interface? I mean, some stuff didn't even occur to me immediately. So that was good, Jay. I mean, interfacing this robotic small intestine with real biological tissue, I can't imagine that being very easy. And everything that the small intestine does, absorbing and excreting and secreting, I mean, what? And if you're maybe a little bit of the intestine, but the majority of it, I think would have a real huge negative impact on the animal and just absorbing the nutrients. We're not there yet. It'd be cool if we were there, but I really don't think we're there yet. There's just too much work that needs to be done to do that. So I'm going to say that one is fiction.
Okay, Rebecca.
Yeah, everybody else talked a lot, so I'll make this short. Deliberately forgetting information, I don't think is like saying don't think of an elephant, because it could be as simple as just identifying a new sort of memory that you can focus on that might sort of overtake whatever it is you're trying to forget. So I think that could be true. And pigeons recognizing faces also seems very true. I mean, we've known for a while that I think that birds like crows are very good at recognizing humans and other tricky things like that. So I think that's plausible. And so I have the same problems with the small intestine idea as everybody else, well as Bob and Jay. And I hate to do it because I know this isn't going to advance my contest with Bob, but
don't do it
I'm
then.
Gonna GWJ.
Yeah.
I'm gonna say the robotic small intestine is fiction.
Okay, so you all agree that research suggests that pigeons are very adept at recognizing human faces, and that one is science.
Cool.
Yeah, not that surprising. These were wild feral pigeons, not trained pigeons. And what the researchers did was to have two scientists with similar coloring, you know, both female, similar colored skin and hair and everything, wearing different colored lab coats. And then they would throw feed on the ground for the pigeons, and one would just stand there while the pigeons ate, and the other one would chase the pigeons away and scare them. Then the next day, they would repeat that, and the scientists would switch coats, and then the pigeons would avoid the person that tried to scare them away the day before, but not the one who didn't. So they respond. They did not respond to the color of the lab coat, despite the fact that that made up the majority of the person. So the researchers say that this suggests, and I just use the term suggest, it certainly doesn't prove it, that they may in fact be recognizing the faces of the people. They tried to control for all of the variables. The one thing I didn't see, though, the variable that I did not see how they or if they controlled for it was smell. How did they know the pigeons aren't just smelling the difference between the two people?
Good.
Hmm. And pigeons.
Do pigeons have a good sense of smell?
They have an awesome sense of smell. In fact, I was on a.
Why do they eat garbage?
I was a guest on the Incredulous podcast, and we talked about a news item where pigeons were shown to rely heavily on their sense of smell when navigating. They actually have an olfactory map of the environment.
Ooh,
and they can
olfactory?
They could navigate based on smells.
And that is awesome.
The researchers were able to decrease their ability to do this by plugging up one of their nostrils.
Why? I'm sure the pigeon loved that.
I would wonder how stable that kind of map would be, but I guess there are certain, certain smells that are just fairly constant over a certain terrain.
Yeah, if you have a restaurant or something, yeah, that might be a source of cells. So anyway, this is a presentation, not a published paper, so I don't have anything except for the press release to go on, unfortunately. So I don't know how or if they controlled for the pigeons just being able to smell the difference between the two people. But that not being the case, it's reasonable. And you're right, there are lots of birds, you know, who are very smart and who can apparently recognize faces. So it's not that much of a stretch. Let's go to number one. A new study shows that it is possible to learn how to deliberately forget information. Evan, you think this one is the fiction. Everyone else thinks this one is science. And this one is science.
Science, yes. Mm.
Sorry, Evan, you did not repeat Jay's feat from last week. Nice try. That was brave of you to go against Jay.
Rebecca and Jay, ready, high five.
There's a couple of interesting wrinkles to this study. A couple of you mentioned, you know, what kind of memories. And actually, the researchers are careful, I think Jay brought it up as well, are careful to mention that they only looked at so-called neutral memories. Mm. They were not studying traumatic memories, which may not behave the same way. But they were able to train the subjects in the study to repress or suppress the memory of something that they were exposed to. And they also did EEGs during this process. And what they found that was very interesting was that the same part of the brain became active when you restrain a motor impulse as when you suppress a memory. So there's essentially an inhibition module, you know, don't do this thing. And it was that part of the brain lit up in either case. They also found that for those memories that they were told to repress, they became harder to recall. The more they were suppressed or repressed, so deliberately trying to repress the memory made it actually worked in that you then couldn't remember it later. Got rid of the memory, and there's a mechanism for it. There's part of your brain which does that. So it still remains to be seen if this could be applied to things like people who have depression and can't help but obsessing about negative thoughts or ideas, or the holy grail, post-traumatic stress disorder. You know, if you could forget the trauma and get rid of the PTSD, obviously that could be quite an effective treatment. But again, it's not known if this would apply to traumatic memories because they may be different. And this means that Medical engineers report that they have successfully built and tested a functioning robotic small intestine that is capable of replacing a significant portion of the small intestine in an animal is fiction. Yeah. Did any of you see the real news item that I based this on?
Yes, and it was awesome.
No.
I loved it.
Yes, I almost
awesome
I was hoping to catch somebody who just read the headlines. Researchers engineer functioning small intestine in laboratory experiments. But this is a tissue-engineered small intestine, not a robotic small intestine. That's the difference.
Oh, I'm thinking of something different then. Never mind.
Okay, you were thinking of yet another news item?
Yeah, I was thinking of another news item that was really cool.
Which one?
Basically, a robotic arm that could go into the stomach, and it could actually do surgery within the stomach, but it could also make a hole in the stomach, go out of the stomach, and then do repairs elsewhere within the body, and then it comes into back into the stomach, sews up the hole, comes back out, bam, you're out of the hospital. Instead of an 8-hour surgery, you've got like a 45-minute surgery, and you're out in no time, no incisions. I mean, it's just like a really cool advancement in robotic surgery, a robotic arm, remotely operated robotic arm.
Cool. Like the alien crawls inside of you and then does surgery from the inside.
Yeah.
Cool.
Now that's cool.
That is cool. So you had the robot part, but I had the artificial intestine part.
Right. What was that, Steve? What did you get it from?
Like I said, they used tissue engineering to grow an intestine, a small intestine, and they put it in a mouse, and it worked.
Oh, sweet. Okay, I didn't hear that.
I almost didn't pick that one, too. I was like, oh, it's too obvious.
Well, you know, as I say, sometimes I got to put the obvious one in there so you don't get complacent. But I was also inspired by a science fiction novel by Isaac Asimov. I remember doing, was it iRobot? Not the movie version, but the novel version where a robot is like the first robot to become really sentient and self-aware.
The Bicentennial Man, was it, Bob?
Oh, maybe, yeah, Centennial Man. Then he goes on a quest to become more and more human-like.
Yes.
And he actually invents
Bicentennial Man.
But he invents an artificial intestine to replace his own intestine. Yeah, so. But we're not anywhere near doing that.
No.
Yeah, you guys brought up a lot of good reasons why it would be very challenging to do that. Mainly, I think, absorbing the nutrients into the blood system. That interface would be the big thing. Yeah.
Huge.
So good job, everyone, except Evan. Jay, do you have a quote this week?
I do. I have a quote sent in by a guy named David Dixon.
Uh-huh.
He happens to live in the United States. He sends me this awesome quote. And then he says, here's the name of the author, William Cecil Dampier Wheatham. And he says, yes, two Dampiers in his name. I would love to hear Jay yell that out. So the quote actually is awesome. So the quote is, if agricultural land be left uncultivated, in a few years the jungle returns, and signs are not lacking that a similar danger is always lying in wait for the fields of thought, which, by the labor of 300 years, have been cleared and brought into cultivation by men of science. The destruction of a very small percentage of the population would suffice to annihilate scientific knowledge and lead us back to almost universal belief in magic, witchcraft, and astrology. William Cecil Dampier Wheaton!
I love how your voice cracked at the end.
Holy crap.
Classic.
Quick announcement. Our good friend Richard Wiseman has a new book out in the United States. It's already been out in the UK, Paranormality. Apparently, the publishers in the United States didn't think that there's a market for skepticism in the US. So he had to be content to publish it in Kindle. So if you have any ability to read Kindle books, you can buy and download it and read it that way.
Sad state of affairs.
It is.
And the United States.
The book is excellent. It is an excellent approach to the paranormal, sort of a fresh approach that I think that even skeptics who are well-read will enjoy.
Indeed, it is.
And we're going to be chatting with Richard about this when we see him next week at TAM.
In detail.
Indeed.
Cor blimey.
Thank you for joining me this week, everyone.
Bye.
Thank you.
Surely. Hey. Nothing better to do.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe.
The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at www.theskepticsguide.org. You can also check out our other podcast, the SGU 5x5, as well as find links to our blogs and the SGU forums. For questions, suggestions and other feedback, please use the Contact Us form on the website, or send an email to info@theskepticsguide.org. If you enjoyed this episode, then please help us spread the word by leaving us a review on iTunes, Zune, or your portal of choice.